This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
The land between the lakes is the largest inland peninsula in the United States, with over 170,000 acres, 300 miles of shoreline, and 100 miles of walking trails. Contained within the confines of a narrow strip of land between two man-made lakes on the border of Tennessee and Kentucky. It's a wild, sprawling, beautiful place and a popular destination for campers, tourists, and outdoor enthusiasts. But it's also a land where legends abound. It's where native peoples hunted and from which later settlers were forcibly displaced. A land of strangeness and unexplainable phenomena, which run across the spectrums of cryptozoology, hauntings, UFOs, and more. That's on tap for tonight's show. You're tuned into the very best in paranormal programming. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is My Paranormal 60.
I'm not gonna stand here and listen to this baloney.
He won't float. He doesn't stand for baloney.
Sounds like a lot of supernatural baloney to me.
Supernatural, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not.
Good evening, friends and darklings around the world. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Paranormal 60. Ladies and gentlemen, investigator, researcher, author Aaron Deese, his new book is Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes. You like the sound effects, Aaron, huh?
I love that. That's the coolest that that title has ever sounded. So thank you.
Not a problem. Exciting stuff. Talk to me about this area, this land between the lakes, this whole historical site, and give us kind of an in-depth look at why this place is so popular and why you believe it's so wrought with paranormal kind of energies and beings.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is difficult to do with brevity because there's a really intricate and deep history in this place that goes back to, at least if we're talking about European settlers, the 1700s. And that's when you had people setting up shop along what was at the time the land between the rivers, because they were not always lakes. And there were Native American peoples in the area before that, but the historical record suggests that there were not any permanent settlements there, that it was used as a hunting ground and a place for resources, but that they didn't permanently occupy it. Why is a matter of some debate. Some people speculate it's built because it's cursed, because they knew about the dog men that lived there. I haven't seen anything to necessarily suggest that, but that being said, there's nothing to suggest that Native Americans lived there permanently. Fast forward to the 1960s, and President Kennedy signs an act to convert the area into a national recreation area. This is done after his death. The actual work is done in 1964, but several is an understatement. American families were displaced through eminent domain. The Tennessee Valley Authority came in and removed these folks. And different accounts seem to suggest 900 families. I've read a couple that say as many as 2,000 families. But either way, we're talking about a few thousand people taken out of what were at the time their ancestral homes, because most of these folks, you know, their ancestors settled there back in the 1700s, 1800s. Mm-hmm. So jump forward to today. And this was done, sorry, I should say why. This was done under the banner of making, again, a national recreation area, a place for hunting, fishing, camping. It was going to bring tons of revenue, tons of people into the area for both states, and just be this big economic boom. That was the idea. Fast forward to today, and that hasn't really happened. It is a place that a lot of people go for hunting and fishing. It is a very popular destination, especially for off-roading. That came up a whole lot in my research. People like to off-road there. But it hasn't seen the attention that is due a stretch of land where all of these people were taken out of their homes. It was so important to take them out of their homes. But today it's very neglected. The roads are overrun. They're overgrown in a lot of cases. There are a lot of abandoned structures that are not sound, that are very dangerous. And I should say, since I started writing this book, an act was passed to provide additional funding to the Land Between the Lakes on an annual basis. That was done in 2022 or 2023. So that is hopefully going to change very soon. But for a really, really long time, it's just kind of been sitting there. As of last year, there were only five park rangers for 170,000 acres. Wow. So, yeah. And that enough would be kind of strange that the government came in and did all of this work and displaced all of these people and then just sort of let it sit there for several decades. But then you have this backdrop of paranormal activity. People have seen ghost lights or phantom lights, whatever you like to call them, you know, in the trees. There are rampant Bigfoot sightings. You could write one more or several more books just about Bigfoot sightings in the Land Between the Lakes. Tons and tons of hauntings, which might seem like a natural thing because there are over 200 some cemeteries there. I forget the odd or the exact number right now. It's a very, very strange place. And the thing that they did when they came in here, they didn't just remove these people and say, we're turning this land into a park. They flooded the two rivers, creating the Kentucky Lake and Lake Barkley. And so all of this land that people lived on, you know, town main streets and cemeteries, it's all underwater now. You know, it's not obviously not the entire place, but it was not a peninsula. It was not always like that. So mm-hmm. You have massive upheaval of both people and land set against the backdrop of all of this paranormal activity. So that was kind of a rambling answer, but I hope that suffices.
Well, certainly full of history and mystery in some instances when you have that much activity that's being noted. Now, are we seeing that most of this activity is being kind of kept track of in current day, or do we see historic references to strange beings, ghosts, and more in those areas during the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s?
We see quite a bit of both. A lot of writing has been done on hauntings and ghostly activity there. I reference a few of those in the book. There are anecdotes of stories going all the way back to the early settlers in the 1700s of them having seen these upright walking canine forms. And that comes through correspondence from the Transylvania Fur and Trading Company, or Fur and Land Company, Transylvania Company. Let's stop there because I know that's correct. That there are people that they were sending out there were sending back these written correspondences saying, hey, we've seen these strange upright walking animals. I personally have not seen those correspondences. That comes with some of the witnesses I talked to in the Land Between the Lakes area who have been there for a very long time and are connected with the local history and the local people there. So we do have anecdotes for that. And then again, you jump to the modern day and we have all of these modern stories of people seeing these things. And of course, the most notorious is the massacre of the Land Between the Lakes that is supposed to have taken place in the early 1980s. That's arguably the thing that kind of set me on this whole course of writing this book in the first place, because people would ask me about that case so often when I was writing my first book and I hadn't done any deep research into it. So that's kind of the thing that hooked me with this one.
All right. So you've got an area that you said you could write several books on just about the Bigfoot sightings. But we're here kind of to talk about the dogmen, and, you know, obviously that's the main focus of the book. But is it rare, Aaron, to see dogman and Bigfoot kind of occupying the same area?
It's not, at least not in the scope of my research. There may be areas where that's not the case. But for my first book, I spent a year and a half looking into dogman activity in Texas. And every single area I looked at also pops up on the BFRO map. And I may be exaggerating. I'd have to go back and look at the list, but there's definitely an overlap in these sightings and in the areas that they occur in. We could speculate as to why that is. That kind of takes us into the nature of what these things are, I think, but there definitely is an overlap. Yeah.
That's kind of fascinating and strange to me, just in the sense that there would be two predatorial like creatures that are living in the same area, and yet we're not hearing any, or maybe you are. Are you hearing about clashes between these two titans?
That's one of those things that you hear about it in comments on forums. You see people talk about it on Facebook. I'll see it in YouTube comments. I've yet to come across a credible report wherein there seems to be conflict between Sasquatch and Dogman. There is one sighting that's talked about really prominently in the book where they are seen at the same time and the same place, but they don't seem to be engaging in any kind of conflict with one another that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Is one creature more docile than the other when it comes to the encounters? Now, obviously, you're talking about the massacre kind of being one of the central points for your new book, which makes it sound like the Dogman is very aggressive or can be aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard stories over the last 5, 6, 7 years where Sasquatch, Bigfoot seems to be getting more territorial, more violent in nature. And although there's always been a couple of one-off stories, you know, Alaska here, Kentucky there, where somebody's been attacked by one of these beings, you know, I hear a lot about them throwing rocks and banging on the sides of houses and trailers, but the actual attacks seem pretty limited. What do you know about that?
So I think you're right. I think, one, we are hearing more about aggressive Sasquatch encounters in the last few years. And I think that could be due to a variety of reasons. That's something people are likely to click on, you know, aggressive Bigfoot attacks camper in wherever, you know, oh, that catches your attention. So I think that could have something to do with it. But I do think we are hearing more about that. And we could say, hey, maybe as more people are going outdoors and looking for these things and pushing further into their territory, they're getting more annoyed with us. That's a fun idea I just had. But I'm sure someone else has suggested that at some point.
Right, encroachment. I mean, it's happening to other animals. Why not to these more sentient, intelligent beings?
Mm-hmm, for sure, for sure. In the case of Dogman, though, even if 50% of Sasquatch encounters were extremely aggressive, which I don't think is the case, without any hard numbers in front of me, it still doesn't approach the vast majority of cases in the Dogman world, if you like, where witnesses are left feeling unsettled, they're left feeling terrified. We see symptoms that look like post-traumatic stress disorder. They don't sleep well. They don't want to go in the woods anymore. They're almost in every case described as being aggressive if the witness sees them for more than a few seconds. We do have roadside sightings where they're crossing the road or they're crouched down next to the road, you know, where they don't see them for more than a few seconds. But anytime there seems to be an interaction, it's not a positive one. That seems to overwhelmingly be the case. Yeah.
Aaron, is there a notable difference between the historic and legendary werewolf and what Dogman is?
That is a matter of some debate and of opinion. And it's a very polarizing point within the Dogman community, because you have a lot of people who will say werewolves don't exist. That's a Hollywood invention. People don't turn into animals. But Dogman is a real thing. Dogman is a biological animal that physically resembles a werewolf and walks upright. I think there's a lot of room to make that argument.
The thing I find funny about that, and I've heard people make that argument as well. Oh, it's created by Hollywood. It's not created by Hollywood. The Beast of Jovedan from France. There are many different encounters with werewolf-like creatures. There was, I want to say it was the 1700s, where a werewolf was stalking its village, killing people. And when they finally tracked it down and shot it, it reverted to the local priest. And it's, you know, again, that's like straight out of Stephen King's Silver Bullet novel and movie. But it was, again, something that far, far out exceeds Hollywood's movies and storylines.
Exactly. And that's what a lot of people miss, is that those Hollywood stories were drawn from real life mythology, from real life historical writings. Sabine Barr and Gould. Oh, there's Mr. Martin Groves. Hey, Martin, that's my dude right there. You can read more about Mr. Martin Groves in Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes. Sabine Barr and Gould wrote the Book of Werewolves in 1865, and he gathered stories that were hundreds of years older. You know, so these legends do come from real history. They don't just come from Hollywood. You know, Lon Chaney's Wolfman was 1950-something. 1940-something?
Lon Chaney Jr.? Yeah, I think it was somewhere in the 40s. Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head.
I should know this. It's in the book. You can read the book to find out. But
I'm sure somebody's going to let us know in live chat. I'll keep an eye on it.
Yeah, I should know that. I'll go ahead and just admit that right now publicly. I should know that. But that came from somewhere. So I I think that's something we lose sight of sometimes. Now, whether or not there's an overlap in the supernatural shapeshifter that maybe has some kind of connection to witchcraft and what people are describing in the modern day as Dogman, that's another thing I don't know. Because if we talk about European settlers in the land between the lakes, a good chunk of them were French. French, of course, you know, brought the Rougarou from France, which was the Loup-garou over there. I'm sure I'm pronouncing it incorrectly.
No, so you've got it right from everything I've ever heard. Yeah.
Is that okay? Awesome. Thanks. I feel good about that. So that's at least one case where we can trace a direct lineage of a werewolf-like creature directly to the land between the lakes. Is that what people were seeing and are still seeing today? I don't know. But the Rougarou is not described as decidedly a cryptozoological creature. It tends to fall more in the darker spiritual shapeshifter kind of realm. So it's tough. It's a tough question.
And I want to hold off a little bit around the after the break. I'll talk about the massacre and have you go into that a little bit more in depth, if you don't mind. Sure. But getting us to this point, obviously, when you hear that this being falls more under supernatural umbrella, I guess would be the proper term, right? If we want to say that, you know, werewolves might be shapeshifters, which again, still falling under that supernatural, you know, approach to this, but this seems to be something that supersedes humanity. It's not connected as though it needs human to evolve and to become something. It is just what it is. But there happens to be this glut that literally I have not heard Dogman stories until really The Beast of Bray Road by Linda Godfrey 14 years ago. That was the first. And now all of a sudden everybody's seeing Dogman. So is that because their stories have always been out there? And now that we're researching and can access newspapers from days of yore, we can pull those stories forward again? Or were people more frightened by the coming forward and sharing those stories?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think you hit the nail on the head there, because what Linda did, you know, God rest her soul, she brought this phenomena into a public light in a way that, you know, even in the Bigfoot community, you hear, okay, I saw Bigfoot. Yeah, okay, well, yeah, I know that people have seen Bigfoot. I can accept that even if I don't believe in it. But for anybody to say, I saw a werewolf, that's difficult. That's a difficult thing to come forward with, even if you're really sure of what you saw. So Linda made it possible for people to do that. That also encouraged people in the community like me, you know, to look back at some of these historical cases, look into folk tales local to their area. The Defiance Wolfman in Defiance, Ohio is a great example. You know, that was a local tale that I think started rising to prominence more in the internet age. But Linda did a lot to really get people looking into that kind of thing. The Converse werewolf in Texas, that's another old one that had been hanging around since the late 1800s, early 1900s. But now all of a sudden people are looking at that story, people like me, and asking, does this have a connection to the larger Dogman phenomena? And I think we can thank Linda for that, for sure.
In your opinion, obviously you've done a lot of research, you've been writing these books, you wrote the Dogman Triangle, and you've investigated all these different sightings. Where do you come down on this? Are you a believer that this is a being, an actual being? And if so, is it a flesh and blood being or something more interdimensional?
So I have a hard time with that. And I think you asked me that the last time you invited me on the show about a year ago. Thank you for having me back, by the way. And my answer on that changes probably every 4 to 5 days, because you can look at several cases all in a row that mm-hmm. seem to fit very closely along the line of what we would describe as a cryptozoological encounter. You know, it interacted with the environment around it. It left trace evidence. Other animals responded to it, you know, things like that. I got a good look at it, and to me, it looked very much like a solid corporeal being. It looked like an animal. But then we look at the other side of the coin, and you can find 4 or 5 more cases in a row where this is very much something that seems to be supernatural, that seems to be spectral, or at the very least, it is biological in a way that we do not understand. You know, we're talking about something from the very, very bottom of the ocean that is just so bizarre and beyond what we can comprehend that it affects the witness as if they've seen something deeply wrong and or supernatural. So it's a difficult question. And I've tried to look at it regionally, like, okay, are there more cryptozoological encounters over here versus more spectral encounters over here? And there doesn't seem to be a prominence in one area versus another of one type of encounter. versus another. So I guess that's my long and rambling way of saying I'm not sure. I'm very much of the opinion that there is more than one thing going on here. I don't know what that is yet. I probably never will, but.
Now, would we hear the explanations or the encounters with these dogmen? Are they specifically noting the frontal arms, like the, you know, what we would consider our upper arms? Because I've seen dogs and other creatures. A friend of mine growing up had a dog with only two back legs, and the dog would stand up and walk. It was the weirdest, and he would hunch up and do this creepy looking walk around, but that was the way he got around. So, you know, could it be that there are some of these malformed wolves that are just teaching themselves to walk another way because their front limbs are inaccessible to them?
Definitely. I definitely think that is at least some of what we are seeing. I couldn't point to a specific case and say, yeah, that's where this is happening. But I think when we're talking about this many, you know, all kind of in pursuit of the same topic of an upright canid, it's inevitable that something like that is going to find its way into the mix. And I love that you mentioned that, because we do see examples of that, both of canines in captivity and in the wild, of adapting to bipedal locomotion if they have to. What we don't seem to find, or at least don't see very often, is them doing it unnecessarily. Like, all of my paws are good, but I'm going to stand up on two of them and I'm going to walk or run towards you. That's where we have the eyewitness encounters, but we don't have the videos and the documentation, at least not yet. You know, fingers crossed. But yes, I do think that's definitely a possibility. The difficulty comes in narrowing it down and looking at one report and versus another and saying, this is probably an, you know, adapted behavior versus maybe a different species or some kind of a mutant or hybrid that's adapted this as a permanent behavior, not as a trick or a you know, to overcome an illness.
Have you been able to crack the code and get some elders from indigenous tribes to talk about these creatures and beings, either on the record or off the record?
So my attempts at doing that have not been successful. It's possible that I've just pursued the wrong channels. I did have the opportunity to speak to a couple folks of Native descent during the writing of the Texas Dogman Triangle, a gentleman named Nick out of Medina, who is of Apache descent. And he was shared quite a bit with me, was very kind in speaking with me, and said that this is something I grew up hearing about that is a part of my culture. You know, so I have had the opportunity to do that. In The Land Between the Lakes, unfortunately, I wasn't there long enough to make those connections. I did have quite a few conversations with Mr. Martin Groves, who does know quite a few folks in the area, including Native tribal elders, who have shared with him, you know, to my understanding, that this is something that is known about. I personally have not had the opportunity to have those conversations yet, I hope.
What is the overall concept? I mean, I know that some of the indigenous tribes people have spoken a little more freely about Bigfoot, and they seem to either just treat them as though they're just another creature that they've learned to live amongst, but they avoid, or that they've treated them as though they're another tribe. And in some cases, they've referred to them as cannibalistic tribes, and they do their best to avoid that. What are we hearing from the indigenous peoples regarding the dogman? Is this something that they just learn to live with? Is it a threat, a protector?
I'll be honest with you, I don't know.
Then lie to me.
Okay, so I can give you my opinion. I think part of the reason that may not have come up as much as we're researching this area, one, we know that European settlers came in and took these lands. We know that they were used by Native Americans at the very least as hunting grounds and tribal areas. So it is very possible that there are a lot of records that were lost or intentionally destroyed. I'm guessing, but that's a possibility. Due to the fact that there were not Native or permanent settlements there, it's also possible that those legends aren't showing up there because they weren't there permanently. Does that make sense?
Sure.
That makes sense. Okay. It is also possible that the people that know the truth behind that stuff, I have not met them yet, or they have not come forward into the public light. That was part of the challenge in writing this book is a lot of pieces of history, like what you just mentioned, they're not online. They're not in books that I've run across yet. So having people like Martin Groves, who are from that area and who do have those connections, was indispensable. Also, Elijah Henderson, the Cryptid Studies Institute, Jesse and Joe Doyle spent quite a bit of time there. Dewey Edwards, Mike Smith. I'm sure I'm going to forget to name somebody, but all the folks in that area, you know, were able to point us in the right direction versus just wandering in there blind, which is what it would have been without them. So,
well, for the record, folks, if you know and you might have history on these beings and you're tied to Native culture, indigenous tribes, and are willing to share this insight, how can people reach out to you, Aaron, and how do they share that information with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Aaron@smalltownmonsters.com. And I'm more than willing to admit when I don't know something, that's the whole part of this. I don't know what dogmen are, but I'm interested in them. So please tell me when I'm wrong and tell me where to look for the right answer, because I don't know.
I'd be careful with the tell me when I'm wrong, because there's a lot of opinions. And many people have very violent opinions when it comes to these strange beings. Be polite. If you have insight that you think Aaron may have missed on, constructive with the information that you share. And I mentioned that just because sometimes people don't think, they get very frustrated and passionate about a topic, but we're all here for the same reason, a fascination and a want and understanding to know what these beings are and what's going on. So if you have insight, please reach out to Aaron and give him that email address again, Aaron.
Yes, absolutely. Aaron@smalltownmonsters.com, just like it sounds. Yeah. Perfect. And I readily admit that by nature, this is an incomplete work because I don't have all the answers. I can't give you a comprehensive overview of every tribe that was in this area or every family that was there. You know, I haven't dug through records in courthouses or anything like that in Tennessee and Kentucky. So I am sure there are missing pieces. Anybody has them, send them my way.
Why don't we do this? We'll take a quick break now and then come back and get into the massacre story and get a little bit of an understanding of maybe one of the more violent experiences associated with Dogman. The name of the book is Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes, author Aaron Deese, our guest. We will be back. We've got more to discuss, and we'll do that right here on the very best in paranormal programming. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is the Paranormal 60. All right, my little army of darklings, you know that I would follow you into the gates of hell and beyond, holding your hand in proud battle. So I'm going to ask you to trust me on something. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by just about every overpriced wireless provider out there, if I've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, I thought, yeah, all right, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't a catch. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings on directly to you, my little darklings. I can tell you, making the switch has saved me hundreds of dollars, and that's no exaggeration. With all that we had going with our phones and the amount of phones that we had on our plan, it was insane. And every carrier was the same, overcharging, overpricing, and fees I wasn't expecting. So say goodbye to your overpriced wireless plans and those jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with a high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered to you on the nation's largest 5G network. So now you know what I know and understand why we made a change in the Schrader home. It's time you do that as well. So to get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/P60. That's mintmobile.com/P60. Cut your wireless bill to just $15 a month at mintmobile.com/P60. There is a $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to just $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plans. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions do apply. See Mint Mobile for details. The Oregon Bigfoot Festival and Beyond is back and bigger than ever. At Oaks Amusement Park, Saturday, June 29th. Meet Bigfoot hunters like Ronnie LeBlanc of Discovery Channel's Expedition Bigfoot and Paranormal Caught on Camera. And paranormal investigators like me, Dave Schrader of The Holzer Files and the Paranormal 60 Podcast. Join us for a day of family fun celebrating Bigfoot, ghosts, UFOs, and everything beyond. You never know what you'll find. Don't miss the Oregon Bigfoot Festival and Beyond, Saturday, June 29th at Oaks Amusement Park. Get tickets today at OregonBigfootFest.com. OregonBigfootFest.com.
The Oregon Bigfoot Festival. Oregon Bigfoot Festival.
Hey, don't forget, my friends, if you're looking for those perfect Squatch stitching shirts, and you'd like to get your hands on them, you can check out the Paranormal 60 Swag Shop. We've got Bog Squatch. We've got Sand Squatch. We've got Dune Squatch. We've got Bigfoot, Yeti, all of the cool designs and creatures available for you. Go check out Paranormal 60 Swag Shop for more information. And while you're there, check out our new Scaro graphic tees, available only at the Paranormal 60 Swag Shop. All the strange cryptids come together, plus aliens, ghosts, dogmen, Mothman, Nessie, Bigfoot, and more will be added as time goes on. All of these can be found right at the Paranormal 60 Swag Shop. All right, we are back. Aaron Deese, our guest, and he's got a brand new book that's coming out later this month. We have a link for it in today's program guide. You can go pre-order the Kindle version of it right now. The pre-order for the actual book will be in a few more days, and then the book will be coming out and officially released. What is it, April 24th? Is that correct?
23rd, yes, sir. Pre-orders start April the 9th. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. So check the link that we have below, and that way you can keep up with it. And if you want to go pre-order for the Kindle, that's up and available to pre-order right now. All right, Aaron, let's talk about the massacre. Now that sounds like a big pumped up word for some kind of horrendous thing. Is it going to turn out that maybe a bunny was stepped on by a dog at one point, or is this a real massacre?
So I feel like you have my notes. Maybe you read the book. that is a theory, and it's one that I'm partial to. I do believe something happened to start this legend off. Something happened to get people talking about this. It's entirely possible that someone was attacked by a coyote or bitten by a rabbit, and that turned into a wolf, which turned into a bear, which turned into a werewolf, and then it found its way to the internet.
Nobody wants to admit to having been bit by a rabbit, so they're exactly. Like, no, giant wolf, and it just chowed down on me. Yeah,
yeah, and then via snowball in 2024, the year of our Lord, you and I are having this conversation. So that's one possibility.
Sure.
But the more I looked into this, and the more people I talked to, the more I became convinced that there's probably more to it than just that. Or at the very least, there's more to it than someone just made this up. So, you know.
All right. Well, take us back in time. Yeah. Let's do a little time travel. When did the massacre happen? Walk us through this.
So that is another thing that it depends on who you ask.
I'm asking you, Aaron. You're my guest. So
my research points to 1980 to 1982.
Okay.
There is a gentleman who says that he is a survivor of and witness to the event in question. And talking with him was a part of my research, and that is talked about in the book. And that points to 1982 specifically. But the popular story is that a family was camping in their brand new RV in the Land Between the Lakes when they were attacked and viciously killed by what apparently was a werewolf or a dog man, an upright walking canine form. How that was determined, if there were no survivors, is something of a question mark. And then, of course, we have the witness who comes along a few years later. That's a potential answer to that. But again, I'm not going to state any of this as fact because I don't know.
But, so there was an eyewitness to the massacre.
Mm-hmm.
How many eyewitnesses reportedly?
Only one person has come forward to say that they were a survivor of the event.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how did they escape the attack, the onslaught?
Allegedly by hiding under the RV. So the family had just shown up at this campsite. They were kind of setting up, scattered about, performing different tasks when these creatures set upon them, came out of the woods. And the survivor, who was a friend of the family, a gentleman goes by the name of Roger, witnessed this event happening and crawled under the RV and hid until these creatures went away. The narrative continues that, you know, law enforcement descended on the scene, people in unmarked vehicles, possibly military. The RV was towed away. The campground was closed down. It was all covered up. No one knows what happened to the bodies. No one knows anything, really. There aren't newspaper records to support something like this happening. When you do research into the areas where the family is supposed to be from, we weren't able to find records that supported that they lived there on property there. Doesn't mean those records
Words is hard. We understand that.
They are, man. Goodness gracious. I'm usually talking to a 1.5-year-old. So, doesn't mean those records don't exist. Just means that we weren't able to find them. And by we, I mean myself, Heather Mosier, and other members of the Small Town Monsters crew while we were filming for the documentary companion to the book, which is called Dogman Territory, Werewolves in the Land Between the Lakes.
But could you trace back a genesis point for this story? Obviously, you said it's kind of hard depending on who you talk to, but it seems to be around the 80s. Is it just kind of accepted as local legend and lore? Are there people that swear this is something that's going on and that there's still a beast stalking the area?
The consensus among people I talk to in the area, for example, Elijah Henderson and Michael Smith, seems to be that this is an event that happened in this area. Mike Smith grew up in the Land Between the Lakes area in the Tennessee-Kentucky border, and heard about this story in the 80s in high school. So at the very least, we can point to one witness who heard about this story before the internet age, before social media, before discussion forums. I think the Air Force was working with the internet in the 80s, but you know, I didn't have it. So
Al Gore had not perfected his invention yet.
Not just yet. Yeah. Right. And that's actually talked about in the book as well. When the internet came into wide use versus when this story can be traced to. So we do know that it was talked about at one point in time, early on, very shortly after it's supposed to have happened. So that's one of the things that kind of pushed me more towards the believer side, I guess, is that if this isn't a creepypasta, where did it actually originate? And yes, urban legends and urban myth have been with us since the dawn of humanity. There are plenty of things we can point to from before the internet. But if this was just an urban legend, why are people still seeing these things in 2023, which was the most recent sighting I wrote about in the book?
It is interesting, though, when we lean into the concept of urban legends, right? Because I grew up in Illinois, and I remember very clearly, I used to hang out at Stratford Square Mall in Bloomingdale, Illinois. That was our trolling grounds, our hunting grounds as teen boys for teen girls, right? We stalked the malls, and I remember distinctly hearing, I was gone for a week, and I'd come back, and I ended up hearing this tale that a woman went out to her car, put her stuff in the trunk, got in, and sitting in the passenger seat was an elderly woman. And she's like, ma'am, what are you doing in my car? She's like, I can't find my car. Can you just take me home? My son can come back with me and help me find the car. And the woman's just getting this really weird vibe. Something's off. She's like, yeah, I can, but I have to run back in real quick because I'm picking up a package. I just want to drop this stuff off. I'll be right back. And the woman's like, okay, thank you. And she gets out and goes in and gets security. Security comes around and they're talking to the woman, and they're, you know, they open up the door, they're talking with her, and something set off their alarms. One of the security guards actually grabbed her and forcibly removed her from the car, and she was sitting on a hatchet and a wig fell off. It was actually a very slight man dressed as an old woman. And it spread like wildfire. Everybody was talking about this story. And I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. And like, I don't know, 7-8 months later, I'm visiting with cousins from Florida. And I'm like, did you guys hear this story? And I start telling them, and they're like, no, that happened in Pensacola because we were talking about it at our high school. And I'm like, what? And, you know, at that time, we're all like, was there like this band of renegade slight men dressed as old women trying to kill people? Or is this building off of the old, you know, Richard Gere hamster kind of mythology that just kind of starts somewhere and spreads like wildfire, and everybody knows somebody who knows somebody that it happened to?
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the questions you have to ask is, there's also the idea that this is an allegory. You know, it's interesting that this happened to a family, and it happened in a place where so many families were forced from their homes. You know, in that way, we could look at this as an allegory for the Land Between the Lakes itself. And that's a point that Mr. Eli Watson pointed me towards while I was interviewing him for the book. So I can't take credit for that. But, you know, you have to wonder, you do have to wonder, is this something that spreads by nature of what it is and the area in which it originates, or is it based in fact? It's a tough one. Yeah.
Right. And okay, a lot of people were forced off the land. A lot of people were pushed out. Is this a way that the government is trying to instill fear in people so that they're not continuing to go there? Does that mean something more nefarious is taking place there? What do we know about UFO visitations and sightings in that area? Is it something or government facilities nearby?
They're a thing that we know exists. And I can point to two prominent cases that took place a lot closer than I think people realize. The Kelly Hopkinsville encounter, which involved UFO sightings by multiple witnesses, response by law enforcement, and then people engaging in actual armed combat with these small little goblin things on their property. That's only about 30 miles from the Land Between the Lakes. The Thomas Mantell incident, which is the only recorded incident in U.S. history that we know of a U.S. service member losing their life while pursuing a UFO, that craft was moving in the direction of the Land Between the Lakes in Kentucky. Doesn't necessarily mean they have a connection, but it's interesting, and it's a fact that those things took place very close to this area. There are numerous UFO sightings that we hear about around the Land Between the Lakes, and I heard many, many anecdotes when we were actually there talking with witnesses of, you know, we hear about UFO sightings here, we see strange lights in the sky. So there's definitely a presence there. Whether or not there's a connection is something I can only guess at. But we definitely see, like with the Sasquatch stuff, we definitely see some overlap by proximity.
Mm-hmm. Right. Fascinating, because it does seem like are these stories being propagated to keep us afraid, you know, Scooby-Doo style, where Mean Mr. Jones is wearing the werewolf costume to keep people off the property because there's something else going on there, the old gold mine nobody knows about. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but believe it or not, we've been misled by our government before and told stories to instill fear to keep us from visiting or seeing or going to places. And that, entails, conspiratorial angle towards it. But when you start looking at all the red flags popping up in that vicinity, it seems like maybe they are trying to keep us out of there, and maybe for good reason.
Yeah. And it's not conspiratorial to say we know our government has done shady things, you know, behind a curtain before. That's a fact. We have declassified documents that point to that in many, many cases. So it's not too much of a leap, I think, you know, when you're exploring this stuff, to look at a very strange place like this, where the government did play such a large role in turning it into what it is today. And then to look at this strange phenomenon and go, okay, is there a connection there? That may be a little conspiratorial, but it is something I enjoyed exploring a lot while I was looking into this, because that's one of the theories. That's something that people speculate about, and in some cases have even said they believe to be true, that there is a government cover-up at play here, whether it's covering up the existence of these dogman creatures or whether it's covering up something else that they're doing. That's where it kind of starts to get really murky. And that's the nature of the conspiracy genre, niche, if you like. It takes us into many, many realms of speculation, but that is all also in the book as well, because it's a part of it. It's a part of the story of this place.
It makes me wonder as well about these type of beings, their capabilities of, are we seeing multiple beings, or is it all one collective that just takes the visage of whatever it feels might be the most intimidating for the moment? You know, whereas if it's a Sasquatch, if that's its natural form and it feels like people are encroaching and coming into its area, can it transfigure itself to look more menacing like a giant wolf creature to keep you from approaching, keep you from accessing the area more? Is there more to it with what these beings really are? And are we seeing the true nature of what they are? Or is it a projection, you know, almost like an psychological avatar? Because so many people that have claimed to have run into Bigfoot have had that moment where they're almost hypnotized, right? I don't know a better way to say it, but they'll stand there and they'll kind of see the Bigfoot. The Bigfoot will acknowledge them and then move on, and they don't feel the urge or right to reach for their phone. They don't do anything. They go home, and sometimes, and in some instances, it's months before the memory comes back to them of having that moment. Or there are some people that have made claims to get telepathic messages from these beings. So if they do have this influential nature about them, or infrasound, where they're able to scramble our perceptions, it makes me wonder what we're actually seeing.
Yeah. And you make a really good point, because then we kind of get into the question of shapeshifters, and the shapeshifter motif has been associated with the upright canine form pretty much since the get-go, as far as we can tell. This idea of an organic dog man seems to be more of a recent thing, unless we're talking about like the stories of the cynocephali and Saint Christopher. But I think at this point, historians are reasonably convinced that those are the result of mistranslation. But that's a whole other thing. But the idea of a demonic entity that takes the form of an upright dog, we see that as far back as ancient Mesopotamia. We see that again in Europe with the Luguru and with the werewolf trials of the Middle Ages. We see it still in modern America with some of these incarnations, like, again, the Luguru in Louisiana, where we're talking about a spiritual being. So even if there is something that is a animal form, you know, that we're misinterpreting as something spiritual, we have made this association with it as something evil that can change forms for a very, very, very long time. So I think that's an important question.
I worked as a bouncer in college at a nightclub in Winona, and fear and intimidation is an interesting element for people. And there were a few times when we would have people start to dust it up, and I would break it up and bring people outside till the police arrived. And on a few of occasions, it was really interesting. I mean, I'm a 6'1" guy, so I'm not a little fella anyway, but I had people, you know, that I was holding until the police showed up, and the cops are like, "What's going on?" And they would explain it. And then they go, and then this huge guy dragged me out of the bar and threw me out here, and this guy won't let me go back in. And the cop's like, "Who's this huge guy?" And they turn to me, and I'm like, "I was the one that brought him out here." No, that guy was huge. He was like 6'5". And I, you know, when you're in a sense of anxiety and fear, it makes me wonder how our perceptions, and obviously that might have had a couple of drinks and imbibed at that time, but how do you perceive me standing in front of you as being a completely different being than what it was, you know, that you encountered inside the bar? You know, I think perspective is an interesting element to how we're experiencing these creatures, and how do we gain a full insight? I take a lot of the cryptozoological experiences with a grain of salt, and I don't mean to sound dismissive when I say that, Aaron, but I know as a child seeing something, to me, it looked like it was 10 feet tall. But again, I'm sure if I was going back there in my adult height, it might have been 6.5 feet tall. But because of my perspective and the tall bushes and the hand pushing down the bush and the thing looking at me, it gave me a forced perspective of being much larger than it really was, or possibly it was. Mm-hmm. So we're very fallible, and we can be easily tricked in a moment of fear or surprise. So, you know, I often wonder how many of these are completely misinterpreted natural creature sightings for people who, like me, are not avid outdoors people. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know what a coyote with mange looked like, or a bear with mange. And I've seen the photographs, and they look disturbingly like some kind of otherworldly creature. So could we be dealing with, you know, a bear that's heavily matted and gross, and, you know, just kind of overgrown hair? There are different bears that grow hair much longer than like black bears and such. So that's why I said I'm always so speculative of what it really is and what we might be encountering out there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm gonna make your point, and then I'm also gonna present a counterpoint.
Take it away from me. I like it.
Yeah, we often hear in these stories, more often in Bigfoot, because I think there are more Bigfoot stories in the public eye, but it was 10 feet tall, it was 12 feet tall. You know, folks may recall around Halloween, there was a a skeleton decoration for your yard that was available at Home Depot that became very viral because it was 12 feet tall. Enormous. When you'd see pictures of it next to a one-story house, it's taller than the house. So if we're using that as a reference point for 10 to 12 feet tall, Bigfoot is almost the size of King Kong, you know, if we're saying that these things are 10 to 12 feet tall. I'm not saying that they're not. I'm not saying that those eyewitnesses' stories are not valid. But we do have to break these things down and go, okay, what does 6 to 8 feet tall look like in the real world? What does 8 to 10 feet tall look like in the real world? And it doesn't mean that that witness didn't see an upright canine form, but we do have to account for the fact that maybe this was something that in a moment of duress, you identified a threat and it looked much bigger to you than it actually did. I do think there's room for that. The difficulty with that comes when you talk to people who are seasoned outdoorsmen, who are used to hunting, who spend a lot of time in the woods and camping and in the parks, and they see these things and they go, something is not right here. This is not normal. This does not fit within what I understand. And I ran into that quite a bit, both in Texas, mostly talking with ranchers and farmers out here because we have so many of them.
Texas, they're saying things are bigger there?
You know, it's my understanding. That's not actually true. There's just more of it. It's very poorly organized. But anyway, you know, you talk to ranchers, farmers, hunters, outdoorsmen, law enforcement personnel. You know, these are people that see dangerous animals on a fairly regular basis. And when they see these things and they go, I saw an upright walking canine, there's no way around that for me. So.
I got you. I'm with you on it. It's just, you know. I feel cynical because I host a show like this. I talk about these things. I saw something I believe to have been a Bigfoot, but the nature of people, and especially since the advent of the internet, has been for more and more people to insert themselves into a history that they don't belong in, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I'm very conscientious of the fact that I don't want to be disrespectful and rude or dismiss your account because to you it was very real. But I also, you know, I've been at conventions where I've heard somebody stand up and tell a story, you know, to one of the presenters and then out in the hall laughing about it with their buddy about what a bunch of idiots we are and this and that. So it's really kind of taken some of the shine off the penny for me when it comes to these encounters because I really don't know who to trust anymore.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, how do I want to say that? I was thinking about this just the other day. I think that becomes inevitable at a certain point when you spend so much time talking with people on the subject of strangeness, because a lot of this stuff does become recurring, you know? And so I find in some cases, my mind almost starts to fill in the blanks when I'm taking an eyewitness encounter or doing a report, not just for this book specifically, but I think at this point I've conducted over 150 interviews just across various projects. And it gets to a point where you have to stop yourself, at least for me, and take each story for what it is and for the witness that you're talking to, because it is easy to become, I don't know if jaded is the right word, but like you were saying, you know, and now we are at a point where the paranormal, where the unsolved, even the dogman phenomena is becoming more popular. It is catching the interests of more people. And there will always be a fringe element that, like you said, wants to insert themselves into a narrative. And that's where it becomes very difficult. I'm fortunate in that at least for the two books I've written, I don't think that's the case. You know, I've been very fortunate to meet people that struck me as very sincere, but I'm sure I can be fooled. So,
right. Well, that's the whole problem. And that's why I've said, I try to be not judgy about some of the situations and encounters. You know, I'm working on my second book as well, and I've got a really interesting story that a listener had shared with me about an encounter with a mother bear, a bear, and a Bigfoot, and watching this, you know, Godzilla versus Kong epic battle unfold in front of them. And part of me is like, what the hell? How this sounds so absurd. But then again, what would it look like? Of course it would be absurd. You're watching Bigfoot in a WWE SmackDown, no holes barred match with a mother bear who we know is very protective when in the company of their cubs. So it's so weird to consider these things. But again, that would be a natural part of natural selection, right? These beings coexisting, and once in a while they're going to piss each other off.
Yeah. And we have to ask ourselves a question, like, at what point are we beyond the pale? You know, okay, we're already talking about animals that might not exist, you know, possibly an ape, possibly a canine. That's pretty crazy. Okay, well, now maybe we're talking about a spiritual being or something spectral, something we don't quite understand how it interfaces with reality. So at what point is it too bizarre that we say this story doesn't work? It's not believable enough when we're already talking about werewolves, you know?
Right.
Where's the cutoff? For me, I don't know where it is. So I've kind of made the decision when I'm researching a certain area, and there are some stories that have come my way that I was like, whoa, I don't know what to do with this. You know, I'm not going to omit them from the research for that area just because I can't fit them in that same box as the others. Cause I don't know. I don't know how that fits in. I just know that I'm hearing this story, and this person, as far as I can tell, believes that they saw this thing, but it's very difficult. It can be overwhelming. Yeah.
Has anybody taken an effective shot at one of these creatures where there has been a confirmed hit? So maybe there's blood splatter, hair, DNA, something. And of course, then what do we get if we think it's a giant bipedal, you know, hairy hominid wolf? Are we just going to get, you know, results back that say, yeah, this is from a large species of wolf, and that doesn't really tell us anything more than it's a canine relative?
So that is something that we're missing. We don't have, as far as I'm aware, we don't have blood spatter. We don't have fur samples that we can prove are from, you know, a dog man. We don't have bones. We don't have a carcass. The difficulty with looking at DNA evidence or physical remains or trace evidence with a dog man is, how would we know the difference between if it was a large wolf or some other kind of canine hybrid? I don't know how we would determine that. Decomposition happens very, very quickly in the wild. So if one of these things was to keel over, it's not going to take long for it to break down and very closely resemble a known canine. If we find a dogman skull sticking out of the brush in a ditch one day, we're probably just going to assume it's a wolf or a coyote. There may be a dogman skull sitting on someone's shelf somewhere right now, and that's what they think it is, for all I know. So that's kind of where it becomes difficult. As far as people taking shots at these things, we do have some stories where that's the case. We have some what I consider credible encounters where that's the case. The situations in which these encounters have occurred did not lend the witness the opportunity to collect a sample or to, you know, document it in that way. These are cases where they were trying to get out of what they perceived as a very, very dangerous situation. And I can, you know, mention Mr. Martin Groves as an example, because he was hanging out with us here earlier, you know. So even returning to these areas later on, if you do shoot something and there's a little bit of blood spatter, it's not still going to be there 3 days later. You know, it's just not out in the open elements. So that may be the reason for that. But short answer to your question is that evidence has not presented itself at present.
Yeah. Aaron, you're coming home late one night and you got your big truck, brand new big deer pusher grill on the front. And as you're coming down the road, a huge dog man is bearing down, staring at you from the middle of the road, unyielding. Now, this is your chance. You could hit this wolf with all you have and prove once and for all dog man exists, because you've got it. What do you do?
If I don't have my family with me, yeah, I'm going to go for it. Because even if it is a very big, loose wolf, the areas in which I'm going to see this thing, if it exists, are full of cattle and there are families out there. I drive through the corridors of the Texas Dogman Triangle pretty regularly. So, you know, these are all farmlands where people live. So to me, that would present a threat to people and to property and to livestock. And if I have a truck that's that big that I think I can handle it, yes. If my family's with me, if my son or my wife are anywhere near that vehicle, absolutely not. I'm hitting the brakes and breathing deeply until I think it's gone. So it depends on the situation. I don't advocate cruelty to animals.
Right.
But looking at this as, you know, I'm driving to my parents' place out in rural Texas, and this thing is lurking around their property, absolutely, I'm going to take it out. Yeah.
You're just out in the middle of the Nevada desert, driving through the roads. Nobody's in any immediate danger, and this giant wolf is standing there. Do you hit him so that you can prove to the world that he exists?
Oh,
see, let's the take away are- the, you know, the nature. Because here's exactly what would run through my mind. With my luck, I'm going to hit this thing. I'm going to kill it. and it's going to revert into human form, and there will be Aaron Deese laying on the road. And now I've got to explain to Shannon LeGros what happened to Aaron Deese. And when I try to explain that he was a full-on wolf creature, I'm going to prison, and everybody's going to think I'm insane.
And Shannon will find you. Shannon will find you.
That would be my fear of striking one of these things. You know, same with Sasquatch. It's like, you want to prove it. You'd love, even getting past the accolades and the millions of dollars, I'm sure, that would come your way. The hatred, my God, how many death threats would you get for being the guy to take out a Bigfoot and or a dog man?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be a life changer as well.
And if that's the case, I'm going to have to flip my answer, because at this point in my career, I hope I never see one of these things. I really do, because no one's going to believe me. But of course, I have to talk about it. No one's going to believe me because I write books about it. Of course, I want to see it. So I really hope that I don't. And also, if I'm out in the desert and I'm away from people and it's just me in the wilderness and this animal, I don't care if I have a vehicle. I'm going to just keep on trucking. So
Crystal goes, no, Dave, just take a picture. The problem, Crystal, is there are so many amazing effects on cameras now and special effects you can add later that even if you took a crystal clear picture, fangs bare, blood dripping, claws in my hood, people are going to call me a fake and a fraud anyway, unless I've got the body. I mean, let's just face it. That's what it's going to come down to at this point, is it's got to be you're going to have to share a body. Videotape and photographs just won't cut it.
Now that AI video generators are in the hands of the public, and that's a whole nother debate I'm not trying to have. I'm just stating that now that that technology is so widely available, we are entering a new era where fake paranormal evidence is constantly going to come our way. We're already seeing it. And it's only going to get worse. So yeah, that's the challenge with photographs now, a challenge we didn't have 2 years ago, but here we are.
No. Yeah, exactly. The nice thing is that there are softwares that can deconstruct the photograph and deconstruct videotape to tell you what's been added and what is not natural intent in that photograph or video. So there is that, but they're still expensive programs that you and I and most lay investigators don't have access to.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Aaron Deese. The book Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes, will be out and available on April 23rd. Correct?
Yes, sir.
But it is available to pre-order on Kindle now, and it will be available for the paperback edition to be ordered as of April 9th, so you can pre-order. And it really helps. Please go pre-order these books, because it helps the publishers determine the attention and information and what kind of response you're going to get on books like this, so that they continue to want to publish books. And then rate and review them. Thank you so much for all the people. I'm up over 108 reviews on my book now. Thank you. Please keep them coming. If you bought the book and read it, rate and review it. If you pick up Hunting Grounds, Dogmen of the Lakes, don't just buy it. Rate and review it. Every rating, honest ratings and reviews help, because it exposes to more and more people along the line. Aaron, before we leave, do you have a good creepy story you want to share with us before we say goodnight?
Oh, man. So I'll keep it brief. But one time when I was younger, my friends and I went into the woods behind the neighborhood that I lived in, and we found a place where there had at one time been a very old house that had since burned to the ground. And there was a tree stump right in the middle of this lot with a cat skull sitting on it. And that was the strangest and most alarming thing I ever saw in my life.
You didn't raise 11 children. That's baby stuff so far, Aaron. I need literally diapers, full diapers from multiple children at once. That's true terrifying. Aaron Deese, thank you so much for being on the show with us tonight, man.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave. It's always a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. And give our love to all of your friends there at Small Town Monsters. We appreciate them too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very cool. Interesting stories. Weird stuff to consider. Hey, I wanted to make a quick mention. My Hillview Manor event is coming up May 11th. There's only a handful of tickets still available, and I would love for you to come out and investigate. Hillview Manor was one of my favorite haunts last year. Holy mackerel, the activity, the location itself, the people that work there. We had such a great time, and it is off the charts. Insane haunted. And I don't say that lightly. And I would love to share it with you. And there are a few experiments. I would love some of you that are empathetic empaths and sensitives to help me, because I think there are a few spirits there in desperate need of being heard and helped, and you could be a part of that with us. And if you'd like to do the world a favor and travel and see these things for yourself, I'm heading out to the Festival of the Unexplained in 2024. It's September this year, and joining me, of course, Neil Story, who is one of our favorite haunted historians. But this will be the only way, UK, the only way you could see all three members of the investigative team of the Holzer Files. I'll be there. Shane Pittman and Cindy Kaza will all be at the Festival of the Unexplained. If you feel more like getting into the journey of it, you can join me on our tour September 15th through the 25th in England, where I'll be on tour with Neil Story. And it's going to be an amazing time visiting all of these classic haunted locations, plus Stonehenge, the Hellfire Caves. And part of our trip is going to the Festival of the Unexplained. So not only do you get a tour of the UK, you also get a chance to attend the premier paranormal conference. All this information and more can be found on the site darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. Or just head on over to paranormal60.com, and you'll see that little button up there that says events. Just click it, and you'll see where I'll be all year round, and I'd love to meet you. I'll be doing signings of my books, hugs, and more, so come on out and see me at these events. And I hope the information we shared here tonight was as intriguing for you as it was for me, and there are stories to be told and stories to be shared. Reach out to Aaron if you have had an encounter or you have insight that might help him in the evolution of bringing this story forward. If you are of Native descent or from another country and your family or friends know about these beings and have history with it, please share, because the more we can share this information, the more we make the darkness just a little more light, like we try to do every week right here on this program. Thank you for making me part of your journey, and thank you for allowing me on your journey. We will be back, and we've got more great programs headed your way. Why? Because I said so, and I'm Dave Schrader, and this is my Paranormal 60.